This is the Own It Show, where we tell stories of how everyday people made ownership theirs to create extraordinary success.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Own It Show. I'm Justin.
And I'm Elise. Welcome to the show.
And there's oftentimes that you come across people in your life, and the moment that you see them, you have this bond, you have this connection, you have this appeal. And you've heard about it a lot with the past episodes and Brian Maza's HPLT that we were at in Austin, Texas. And I happened to meet this individual. He actually opened up the event, telling us his story, telling us his background, where he'd come from, what he'd accomplished, the trials that he had been through, and what he had overcome. And I don't want to spoil anything, so I'm going to let him tell the story because I can't do it justice. But it was, as soon as he spoke, I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. And his story really spoke to me. It resonated heavily with me because he's a guy that just is the epitome of ownership. He's the guy that's the epitome of owning his circumstances, taking the cards he was dealt and flipping them to ultimately create motivation and own the next phase of his life, take him to the next phase of his life and move him forward, not sit in, sit in my pity, but rather take action and move forward. And as soon as he was done speaking, I had to go up to him, I had to talk to him, I had to get involved with him, I had to do more life with him, because being around people like this, you can only enhance you as an individual. And so I cannot be more excited to share with you guys, Daniel Rodriguez. Thank you so much for coming onto the show and spending a part of your Saturday with us.
No, thank you for those kind words and introduction. And it's reciprocated, right? Like I enjoy spending life or live more life with individuals like yourself who are trying to drive and push and inspire others and, you know, have ownership in this world. I think, you know, not to get off topic here of my journey, but yeah, there's a lack of ownership a lot of times, I feel, and there's, you know, and that is a cultivation of problems and misfortunes, but also a cultivation of excuses to come with it. So, you know, I think if we can take ownership for our actions first and foremost, that kind of puts us in the right trajectory of accomplishing what we want to in our life. So I'm right back at you, man. Thank you for having me. It's, you know, it's always an honor to be a part of somebody's platform or journey or what have you, and share a little bit about myself, because I know you probably have a lot of people, and you know, who am I to speak? So it's a humbling experience. Thank you for the introduction, and I'm really glad to be here.
Daniel, I'd love you to kind of start off and tell our audience a little bit about where you came from, the background in which you grew up, and basically how you went off to war at a very young age, and what drove you there, ultimately leading you to the NFL at 27, 28 years old.
Yeah, I believe, man, dating me now, I believe I was 27 if I had to guess it. But yes, so yeah, I was born and raised in Virginia, in Stafford, Virginia. I was born at Potomac Hospital. This is 1988, so I'm 33 right now. My father was the athletic director at Quantico. So from birth, my mom will tell you, I was throwing socks and tennis balls before I could really actually physically walk. Like, my father wanted an athlete. And I'd get dropped off after school every day at the Marine Corps base, and I would play with all the Marine Corps kids. I did all the wrestling. I saw, you know, the Marine Corps marathon. So my entire life is oriented around sports, teamwork. You know, that wasn't necessarily what I grabbed from it, but looking back on it, that infrastructure of what sports is credible for and great for so many reasons, that was implemented at a young age. So I saw the power of teamwork, what it took to be an Olympic athlete, to see what that kind of strive was. And also, I grew up in a family that was extremely passionate about sports. So me and my father had a great relationship. I mean, we butted heads, obviously. I was like father, like son to some degree. Like, you know, I thought I knew it all, and so did he. So I am a chip off the old block, but he died 4 days after I graduated high school. So I was really pushed through sports. I played AAU basketball, travel soccer. I was a 3-year letterman in high school for football. So literally any sport you can imagine, baseball, I played it all. Like I was really well-rounded. And when he died, it was kind of, I had this facade, the smoke and mirrors, right? Because once you're kind of only in the ecosystem that you dwell in and you're showcasing your talents, you're like, you don't realize the realm of magnitude that the world possesses. So I thought I was this hot shot and I really wasn't anything. And a long story short, in this regard, I barely graduated high school. I was telling Elise, I failed Spanish too. My overall GPA was a 1.9. I never applied myself. My parents were kind of going through a separation in high school. So I had no real stable individual, hey, telling me there's more after high school. You can do this. And my father didn't know his father. So to some extent, he was trying to provide me a better life than he had. And nobody in his high school told him about college. He joined the military at 18. So he was just trying to provide a better life for himself and his family. And when he died, I almost, in a very privileged way, I had a much, much better upbringing than my father ever could have imagined. And my sister did that. My parents both worked extremely hard. But when he died, I realized the opportunity that I kind of wasted in that moment. And at this time, this is 2006 during the Bush administration. And there was a big push for the surge. The war was 2-3 years at this time kicking off. And it was a respectful, admirable decision. I felt that nobody would judge me for what I barely accomplished in high school or the facade I was essentially living, problems at home, et cetera. And that this uniform would give me an opportunity to get out of my hometown, implement structure, build character traits, everything you hear about the military. And yeah, maybe a month after my dad died, graduate high school, I was raising my right hand, swearing foreign or domestic. And not even 3 days later, I was shipped off to Fort Benning, Georgia. I was enlisted as an infantry soldier and immediately went to Fort Benning, did 14 weeks of infantry school, basic training. And 2 days before I graduated, I had orders to go to Hawaii. 2 days before I graduated basic, my drill sergeant called me and he's like, "Hey, you're getting switched to Fort Carson." I'm like, "What? Where the hell is Colorado, right?" And I was actually to become a replacement soldier. The reason my orders were changed so late is that there was casualties taken in Iraq and my number got pulled because it was the same MOS. So in that duration of time through basic or whatnot, thereafter I was shipped off to Iraq immediately after basic training. So 20 days after basic, I was in Iraq. And that was a part of what was a 15-month deployment for my unit. So I was 19 years old and kind of thrown into extreme combat pretty young. My first day in Iraq, I was on mission. I remember my section sergeant telling me, he had a piece of paper. He's like, "All right, tell me your mom's name. Like, what do you like to do?" He's like, "If you get killed, I got to say something. I got to say something about you. I don't know." I remember looking dead, man. "I don't know crap about you, man." I was like, trial by fire has always been kind of my forte, or not my forte, but kind of been my environment for things, right? So I was thrown into combat very young at 19, 20. I did a year over there. I think my unit lost over like 20 people. Fortunately, my sole platoon, we didn't lose anybody else when I was there, but our sister platoons, I had some buddies that were killed. And it was just a very daunting time, if you will, before I was even 20 years old. And then I'll kind of segue this for potentially another question, but when I came back from Iraq, it was a really low time in my life. I talk about, like, it was the first time understanding PTSD or waking up at night being like, "Oh crap, this is PTSD, like this is bad." And I had just turned 20 coming home, so I actually couldn't legally buy a beer or go out or do things that a lot of people find comfort in or vent on. So I was this is like little bitter 20 year old running around the streets of Colorado Springs, not having ownership, right? Like kind of going through the system, if you will, and trying to just figure out, what I had just seen, what I was exposed to. And not even a year later, my unit got called again, and we had orders to go to Afghanistan. So, here I am, just turned 21 years old. And then a month later, I was shipped off to Afghanistan for another year. in Afghanistan, as my story has, the recognition that my story has received is because of my tour in Afghanistan, more or less. Like, Iraq was bad, but what I endured in Afghanistan in my unit kind of put it on under a magnifying glass for the world to kind of see and further the story be told.
So, Daniel, thank you so much for your vulnerability and for taking us through that. It was, you know, based on everything that you've been talking us through, it's, I mean, you were thrown one of those major curveballs in life at an extremely young age, and most people do not have the experience that you had. I know at this point you've told us about your experience in Iran, but you also mentioned that there was a lot of things changed and it got even more intense by the time you got to Afghanistan. Can you tell us about your experience there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's never a really ideal topic for me to discuss war anymore. I think when I was younger, it was romanticized as an American culture. But after experiencing my first tour in Iraq, I kind of had a wave of uncertainty. I think there are a lot of people who like combat, and don't get me wrong, the rush is unreal. Like, there's things that I'll probably never feel again that I only could feel there. But I had the presence of other soldiers under me at this point. So before I went to Afghanistan, I had already experienced soldiers dying in Iraq. So this almost ownership, if you will, for the people underneath you started to rise. And I really didn't want any conflict while I was deployed, right? Like, that was my wish. Like, a lot of young soldiers come in saying, man, I can't wait to go see action. Going into my second deployment, I was really content with what I had already seen in Iraq. And hearing younger guys talk, or guys that were older than me that I was in charge of, that I, you know, I had more time in combat. So you have guys coming in that are 21, officers coming out of school, and I'm 19, 20, and I've already got a year in Iraq. I'm like, you don't even know what you're about to see, my guy. So I went into Afghanistan with a different mentality. You can say mature, but I would just say real, a real reality. And so the deployment was harsh. It was a year deployment. We were in the Hindu Kush Mountains. We replaced a unit out of Fort Hood, Texas. I remember the unit we replaced in Fort Hood, Texas, we replaced them. They go home. This is a side story. They go home, and then there's a mass shooting at Fort Hood, Texas. It was the same unit replaced. Like, I can't remember what year this was, 2009, I would say. So just to kind of give you an idea of, you know, the soldiers at this timeline, what war does after years and years of redeployments to soldiers. So it was hectic. And I was, again, 20, just turned 21 years old. And we were extremely isolated. We were at the bottom of three mountains in the Hindu Kush province on the Pakistan border. We fought pretty much every single day. We'd get small arm conflicts or hit with rocket fire, sniper fire. And it was just everything that I didn't wish for. I mean, I remember my first day in country, we take a helicopter and we land, the helicopter takes us in, get there, and it's completely pitch black. And then as soon as the sun comes up in the morning, we just immediately get hit. As soon as you saw the terrain and how disadvantaged we were in our position, as we were at the bottom of all mountains, it was a disgusting feeling. And then immediately after, we were getting contact. So I was, my fight or flight switched on very, very quickly. Like, I went there kind of, again, I've done this before. Let's make it through this deployment without losing any friends. Let's try to get home in one piece. Like, don't think, you know, kind of just putting yourself through your checklist of what got you through your last deployment, because that's all you really have to base it on. And then the first day opens up, I was just right back where I left off, just being shot at and, you know, having a mode of kill or be killed. And then obviously that morphs into, you know what, I'm at war. I'm out here. So it was a hectic deployment. I'd probably say I was in my 5 month stint leading up to October 3rd, which is the significant battle I was a part of. I was probably in 50 to 100 firefights. You know, it's hard to put an exact number, but, you know, sometimes two a day. Sometimes we wouldn't get hit for a week, and then you get hit for 3 hours. So, you know, I hung thousands of rounds, mortar rounds, thousands of rounds shot out through 240, hand grenades. We had claymores it was an extremely rural position, rural, you know, A-10 gun runs, Apaches, every time we get conflict. We were outside of our range of our 155s, which is the howitzers, which is sort of direct support for pretty much, this is how dumb, and I'm saying this, you know, I'm a veteran, this is how dumb strategically, and it's unfortunate. It's extremely unfortunate because of the outcome, but we weren't even in range of our own artillery, right? So when you build a base out, when you put your cannons, the big guns that you see in the pool of strand, you know, Vietnam footage, we still have those. And they shoot 7 to 8 clicks, and they put a base outside of the range for our own artillery to support us. So we were extremely isolated, just surrounded by all sides. We were getting mail once a month. We would eat one meal a day. We would only get ammunition runs. Didn't have showers. We didn't have any of that stuff. Like, we were literally isolated in the mountains, just fighting. And it was chaos. It was really chaos. We really didn't have any supervision. Like, a lot of, you have to wait for things, right? Like, we're in contact, you know, and we still did, we had ROE, but we were so isolated. There was no chain of command really to, can I fire back? Like you see the movies, or, you know, I need proof. No, we were out there on our toes. Like, the barbed wire 2 feet away from me at all times was the enemy wire. Like, on the other side of that was the enemy. And so, yeah, you're just, it was a very different feel from Iraq. I was in Baghdad in Iraq, and there's more buildings, more city life, right? Like, an explosion would go off in Iraq and it'd freak you out because you'd see kids running like away from the scene, and like women and children like going home. like what the hell just happened? But in Afghanistan, there is nothing. It's like they come out of the mountains out of nowhere, and then you're in it, or they're waiting to ambush you. You're just in it. So
Daniel, what enabled you to get through that? What enabled you to push through and still have a purpose for what you were doing? Because that is, I mean, hearing it even for the second and third time, it is so desolate. It is so hard. And it can really seem, you could have just sat and been like, this is where it is. I'm going to die here.
Yeah. I think the guy next to you, really, you know, the relationships, you know, I look back and I'm very honest with people. You know, I didn't join the military out of sheer patriotism. Like, it wasn't something that I felt drawn for this cause that I wanted to go fight overseas. So when I was there, there wasn't really a lot for me to grasp onto, especially in the day and age of internet. You know, the once a week I could get on the satellite phone, you would see people, on their, you know, Facebook and MySpace enjoying life. And yet the cliche is, oh, thank you for defending my freedoms. And you start thinking, are your freedoms even in jeopardy? Because you're looking like you're having a great time while I'm over here fighting. So really, your mentality for me changed that I just got to get my buddy home next to me. Like, I really got to get my buddy home next to me. Like, this is what I'm committed. This is a volunteer army. I would tell myself that all the time. Like, I volunteered during a time of war. So it is naive for me, or woe is me, to have a attitude that I'm going to die and not make it out of here, when I knew firsthand that this, I might not have known what ingredients of war may have been, but I sure knew it was on the menu, right? And so I a la carte volunteered and walked in. Now, there, you can back up and do a systemic research and research papers of how maybe my opportunity and what have you, but at the end of the day, I volunteered in a time of war. So I would just tell myself when I was over there, do your job. Like, this is what you signed up for. Like, you were raised to finish your duties, like, be like ownership 100%. Like, it's extremely what it is. It's exactly what it is. Like, there's 100 times, I mean, not 100 times, but there was like a few times I remember like just crying, like bawling my eyes out when you're alone sometimes. Like, I'm not afraid of it. Like, I'm not shy. Like, I would just wonder what the hell I was doing. Like, especially Iraq, Afghanistan, Iraq runs on generators. So if the generator runs out of gas, the entire city goes out. And so you go from like this loud city 1 minute, and then 2 in the morning, like 45 minutes, you'll be on guard. Entire city's out. You see all these stars all of a sudden in Baghdad. You're just like, I would cry sometimes. I'd just be like, man, like, what am I doing? And then I had the same waves hit me in Afghanistan. Once once you're that high in the elevation and there's no noise pollution or light pollution, you can literally see the rotation of the stars, like as you're sitting. It's beautiful. But every 3 months or however the solstice works, this moon would be behind the mountains. And if that happens, you wouldn't even be able to see your hand in front of your face. Like the valley is just completely, completely dark. Like you can't see anything. And I felt like once that darkness would hit me again, like I had a chance to kind of let go. And so I would kind of vent, have my moments. But as soon as the lights were back up and, you know, the fight was still there, it was just a matter of making sure that I did everything I could. So I didn't have regret if I were to lose a soldier or myself were to die. Right. So that was kind of what kept me motivated, kept me pushing, through a really horrible time. Like we went 3 months without electricity, like, you know, in one stint. So we're just sitting there. It's just so bad. Like it was so shit. It's part of my language, but it was so bad. It was horrible. Yeah. And then on top of that, you know, you're fighting. So I wanted to answer or like comically when you're like, what kept you going? Like my rifle, my gun kept me going because that's what I was literally holding on to every second.
I know it's at this point you're able to laugh about it, but the gravity that you must have been under and the stress you must have felt every day must have been massive. I mean, you're literally waking up every day fighting for your life. One of the things I want to go back to is something you said in the beginning of our episode today when you were talking about your experience in high school with your father. And how, you know, by the time your father passed away shortly after you graduated high school, that you had realized you were telling yourself a certain story. One of the things that Justin and I talk about often when it comes to ownership is the stories we tell ourselves. And when there's almost this journey that happens that when we live in pre-ownership, we're telling ourselves one story and then something happens or a series of events happens that causes us to shift our mindset around things and really causes us to start to think a little bit differently. I'm really curious. And obviously, you know, sitting here now in the pre-show, you were telling me about what you're doing with your life today. You're in Medellin learning Spanish. And I know there's a series of things that also happened in this post-ownership phase for you to ultimately be living this life that you're living today. Talk to us about that mindset shift or that story shift in which, you know, you were in this one state and now a lot has changed and you're truly living in ownership.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. It just took me down some like reflection points, but I think kind of having a sport background, kind of excelling at sports early on, you kind of put yourself in that starter mentality role in everything that you do, right? You expect to be picked in the first five, you expect to be contributing. And so my mindset as a young adolescent was, oh, I'm good. Like everybody praises me. Everybody pats me on the back. Look at all the trophies I have that I've accomplished. And then once the father passed, like it was an exposure. So all these truths that I've been telling myself, I think at times tragedy is one of the most rawest unveils that can be in a person's life is, you know, rip away the facade and see what's really there. And for me, I had a roof over my head. I was a kid, had a vehicle in high school. I had my license, right? Like I had a very cush life. And then as soon as that was that factor was gone, that variable of support was gone. It was like, oh, I'm a house of cards, right? So that mentality, getting to the military. So I tell you that mentality and kind of getting to the military, having my struggles to Iraq, Afghanistan, sitting in the hills of Afghanistan and talking with my buddy Thompson over and over again, it was a reflection point of what I gave up in my life or what opportunities that were so easy for me to attain if I just had put effort into it, if I had just applied myself a little bit more. So the reality of war was ultimately like the looking glass reflection point of the change of what ultimately become my mindset today, because it was like, wow, you know, I have put myself or the actions or my lack thereof has ultimately been the reason why I'm here. Like, it, again, it wasn't I wasn't drafted. Like I have sympathy for a lot of Vietnam guys who were literally just doing their day to day. And then all of a sudden they got drafted. Like I pissed away opportunities and didn't apply myself and thought I was better than what I was. And then the reality sank in and my good option or the right option was to go join. And that ultimately led to war. So sitting in the mountaintops of Afghanistan, just like reflecting after you're almost killed, really changes the, in my personal experience, it changed my motivation and bandwidth of what am I doing? Like, what have I been doing? Like, why did my father work so hard to provide me a better life? Like, why do, you know, you just start piecing together everything that was so tangible. And now when you're sitting in the third world country of Afghanistan on mountaintops, it's nowhere near you. it's you know, you're on an island. It's an isolation island, not only mentally, but also from the realities of what we have in a first world as American citizens, of what we grew up in. I don't know everybody's background, but of what our country ultimately has to give us, right? We have a chance, a clawing chance, and I just didn't try. So it was just the change of slowly going, okay, this is, I got to do something different. I got to do something different. And then October 3rd, 2009 is, it's known as the bloodiest battle ever in the war in Afghanistan. So myself and roughly 50 other Americans, we were overrun by 400 plus Taliban soldiers on October 3rd, 2009. And, you know, I would sit with Thompson, my best friend back then, and we would talk about what we wanted to do, what we wanted to accomplish, what we didn't get to accomplish, what we let go, all these what ifs, what have you. And then we get attacked one morning, just, you know, a pretty hellacious attack. It seems normal at first, and then it doesn't stop. I remember just kind of like being in this moment, just these rockets coming in. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, wow, this is like, this is a pretty drastic hit right now. And they didn't stop coming, didn't stop coming. So I had to run. I was in this, in our computer station. I ended up running like probably 200, 300 meters uphill. All I had was a pistol, just shooting, shooting, shooting. Bullets are flying. And I realized that this is like a really, this is a really bad fight. Like we're getting hit really, really hard. Everybody's kind of disillusioned. It's first thing in the morning. And the rounds are coming in. I'm just seeing them hit by my feet. I had one, a rock hit me in the shin from a ricochet. I get up to my fighting position. I'm like breathing, like huffing, like adrenaline's going. And I'm like pointing to my buddy Thompson, like, you know, talking, like, I'm like, hey, the enemy's over here. Enemy's over here. 9-3, 9-3. And he just crosses in front of me. And before I can even like get into the fight, really, like I just ran under fire. He gets hit. I see him just kind of drop right in front of us. Boom, just drops. And then, I like go down to assess, you know, I knew what was, you just know, you tell yourself, but you have to see it to believe it. And, yeah, he got hit in the head and dropped by a sniper, like literally at my feet. And, I just charged my 240, I had a machine gun, I had a 200 round belt. Just let that rip. And then from there, it was a pretty hectic day. I mean, that was the first 5 minutes of the fight and it was an 18-hour firefight. Yeah, I threw probably 30, 40 hand grenades. I mean, we were completely overrun. We were killing in and around our wire point blank. I mean, I had shotgun and pistols all laid out. Like we were pretty set, me and another guy, once Thompson was killed, you know, our plan was, it was so bad. We had no comms with anybody. There's a lot that I'm ripping out, but the nuts and bolts of the fight was 18 hour duration, completely overrun by 400 Taliban soldiers. And we were pinned down in our own bunks, killing from where I slept. And so, you know, we had a very, very long day of people not knowing where other people were. We had a POW at one point, or missing in action, excuse me. We'd already had confirmed like 4Ks within the first hour of the fight. I mean, it was bad. It was really, really bad. And, you know, I think we killed probably over around 120, 125 fighters in and around our wire. Like you could walk after the battle the next day. I remember just walking through and things were still on fire. There's just bodies laying everywhere. It's like, what the hell? And the dirt is just like unforgiving because it doesn't really absorb properly. It's not like grass. It's like this red clay. So there's just literally mud, blood mud, like all around, like just this chaotic scene. And, you know, it took bullet fragment in my shoulder. I got hit with the RPG twice. So I took shrapnel on both my legs and my neck, bullet fragmentation through the shoulder. So I was awarded a Purple Heart and Bronze Star Medal of Valor for my actions. But yeah, ultimately 8 Americans were killed in one day. So it was, and that point, I think, nothing to hold a record about, but it was the highest casualty in Afghanistan. My unit was, my platoon, my personal platoon was hit. I lost 8 friends essentially in one day. And then a 9th one killed himself when he got home. So just from that battle alone, it was pretty, pretty gnarly. And then I was 21. So I was like, enough of this. I gotta get out of here. I got home, put in my paperwork, and I was about to turn 22 years old. And I had already seen 27 months of combat and had lost 24 friends in conflict, not even including one thereafter killed themselves. So I was just like, this is enough for me. I didn't want it anymore. I think my mindset had changed in that regard too. And I think it was an ownership of my life at that point. I think it was a subtle nudge of, okay, you've seen what this world can offer, not has to offer, can offer. What are you gonna do now? You're gonna come back here? You're gonna re-enlist? Is this what you want? Is this what your future holds? Or are you gonna go do some things? Are you gonna pick up where that chapter was left off? What is the next bridge for you to build? What is the next challenge for you to accomplish? And what is incredible about the US military to some extent, the teeter-totter, if you will, I gave my time. My education, on the other hand, was paid for. So my GI Bill paid for all my education. And I had all my eligibility. So I really was aspiring to play football. I wanted to be an athlete that I had always dreamed of being since I was a child. And realizing, man, again, I wasn't the biggest guy, but I didn't have counselors help me. I didn't have any coaches tell me, hey, you need to put a recruitment together. Hey, you need to get your grades right. Hey, you need to register for whatever clearing, make sure you're NCAA. I had none of that. I just kind of fell through the system. Like I said, parents kind of going through the thing. And as long as I was kind of skating by, I didn't have any reason to really think that I was doing anything wrong. And so after war, it was just, I had a new objective to go accomplish things. And that's a little premature, because when I got home, I actually did struggle. Like when I got out of the military, I had just gotten done with war. I was 22, I was an E5, I was completely decorated, completely maxed out on awards. By definition terms, the Army did not want me to leave. They were like, please stay, you will fast track. We can see you being a sergeant major one day, blah, blah, blah. I was like, sorry.
You knew what you wanted.
I knew what I didn't want.
You knew what you didn't want, yeah.
And I think something you had said too, Danny, was when they continued to come back to you and say that, you're like, man, I've seen 24 months of combat in my first 3 years. And you asked a governing sergeant, somebody extremely, I don't know the proper terminology, but an extremely high position sergeant, how many battles they had seen, and they hadn't even seen one.
I told him right to his face, because by that time I had already gotten my papers, and they try to give you the last spiel, before you get your DD-214. And he was telling me, Rodriguez, what you've experienced, and they all know we've survived this horrific battle. So, what you can educate our young soldiers on to experience this, that, and other, you'd be a real asset to the military, but you're a rising sergeant, young, 22. He's like, you can be like, to make your 5 and E5 in 5 years is an accomplishment. That's a thing. I made my 5 and 5. I made my 5 in under 3. So I was really, really, really fast tracking because I had so much time overseas. So I had sniper school, all these other long range marksman school, MLOC. I was really, really fast tracking. And I looked him right in the face, bro. I swear to you. And he's not that much bigger than me, but I said, he's Sergeant Major. I was all due respect, Sergeant Major, you've been in the Army 20 years, and I've been in the Army 4. and I have more time in conflict. I have more time in combat than you do. And he just kind of looked at me. I think it was like the first time like somebody had like, wasn't not hearing it, not that he was feeding me BS, but it was the first time somebody had like heard his BS and just gave it right back. So I'm like, no, buddy. Like, and he kind of just looked at me. He's like, hey, appreciate you. Good one, like kind of thing, right? So, but very me that no, nobody's going to talk me into this. I don't care what your rank is. Like, I know what I just survived. And I know, I didn't know what it ultimately was, right? There's obviously been a movie that came out of it. A lot unfolded, a lot of command changes. There were letters of reprimand handed down from this. It really changed the way we set up soldiers isolated in the war. Like, we shouldn't have been, what were we there, right? So it was an unveilment to a lot of horrors, but I had already endured it. So when somebody was trying to tell me otherwise, like my mental positioning had already shifted to, like, I know what I've gone through. And I know that as long as anything isn't as bad as that, I really don't have any more excuses to make with myself. Like, I don't have a child that just was put into a coffin at 20. And, you know, I'm not some mom that's struggling right now. Like, yeah, I'm a friend of a lot of friends that were killed, but I have a lot more left on this runway. And the military at that point was something cut my runway very short of where, before I took flight. So, go ahead.
I want to go and ask you, Daniel, kind of like, because after that happened, after you got back, after you exited out, your life literally took off and you ended up going to Clemson on a full ride. You played for Dabo Swinney. You played with some of the best players that are now currently still in the NFL. You yourself went to the NFL. You starred and played yourself in the Netflix film about this, this battle. You are now filming a new film with Denzel Washington's son. Like, all of these things that you literally are doing whatever you've wanted to do.
And that's a short resume.
And I want you to share with the audience, because Elise always talks about, and we talk about within ownership, is you can literally make whatever you want happen in this world. And it comes with the energy in which you show up, the intentionality in which you partake. And you told a story about sitting in the mountains with Thompson and talking about what you wanted to do, what you wanted to accomplish, and you taking ownership when you left the league, and just the story about filming your first recruiting video, your first little workout video on your phone. Tell the audience a little bit about that moment and what happened in your basically travels to start what you had set out to accomplish.
Absolutely. No. And this kind of, it's a good alignment, because I get out of the military, and before, you know, I have this triumphant like rise of, you know, the underdog, more or less, I really, really struggled. I literally got out of the army, 4 years, all this conflict. And I go back to my same room in high school. My father had died, and when my father passed away, he had a heart attack in the house. So I was like back in a home. Like, all my, you know, memorabilia from high school is all still on the walls, and like, what on earth? So it's like nothing had changed, but everything about me was different. So it was a very deep and dark moment for me for about 6 months, 7 months. I got a dog through this process, which I paid a ton of tribute to, an animal saving my life. I'm all for veterans, or, you know, people with PTSD symptoms and whatnot, to have an animal. They're really special, the bonds you create and love they give. But yeah, I kind of hit this checkpoint where there's a few times I've really thought about ending my life, but I had the buddy I was telling you about that went home and killed himself after the fight. I had written a message on his Facebook page and was like, hey, I'm about to get this dog. It's in North Carolina. It's near you. Hit me up. I don't have your number anymore. I haven't seen you since October, you know, the day we were in conflict. Hit me up. And like 2 minutes later, I get a phone call from another platoon sergeant. I was like, oh man, I was like, what's up, sergeant? It was such a coincidence. I just hit up Faulkner, blah, blah. And he's like, man, I'm so sorry. Nobody told you. But, you know, Faulkner took his life literally within the week. he's like, you know, I'm sorry, nobody reached out to you, buddy, but yeah, Faulkner's taking his life, blah, blah, blah. And I remember that just hitting me like, damn, if Faulkner didn't make it out the other side, like, how am I going to make it out the other side? And so that sent me into a real spiral of like all the negativity, like, what am I doing? I'm living back in my home. I have no purpose. All this stuff, like, you know, telling yourself, I remember like saying, I'm gonna see you again, Dad, I'm gonna see you again, Thompson, like just walk around the house, like just telling myself, like encouraging myself to end the journey, right? And it was kind of in the middle of all this haze. I was outside, I remember having a moment like mowing my yard, like really getting my house as nice as I could. Sitting there crying in the rain outside, the sun's kind of coming out, like it's a sun rain. And I just hear my buddy Tom, he promised me, like, this is what we would talk about in the mountains, like he promised me. And I had this pivotal shift where it's like, wow, like if I end my life right now, if I go down this road, then the Taliban wins. And that was, I remember just telling myself, they win, like, right? Like, it, yeah, I'm not there anymore, but the damage has already been done with what they've done to me. And if I end my life here with all the opportunities at my fingertips, then that's just another L, that's just another W for them. And I remember thinking, you know, if my friends were here, if they had one more chance to see a loved one, what excuse would they make? Like, what would they be saying right now? Would they be crying, thinking about killing themselves? I don't think they would. I think that they would see their mom again, their brother again, or what have you. So that change in attitude was almost immediate when I realized that I had an unfinished promise that I had not yet gone after, or at least tried. And that was the mantra. It starts today. Like, I just literally woke up the next day and just started exercising because I had promised him that I was going to try to play college football. And so I just kept going after it. And then one day my friends, like 3 months into it, they're like, why don't you make a recruitment video? I was like, man, I don't have any high school highlights. I don't know if this will be any good. And I started like working out in my basement with, like, this is before iPhones, right? Or maybe there's like iPhone 2, but I didn't have an iPhone. I had like a Sony cam, you know, digital camera still, you like click and like the lens pops out, right? It's basic. And so I'm putting it on the floor. I don't know anything about camera angles, positioning, lighting. I'm in a dingy basement with, you know, a Fujifilm camera, like, you know, probably 7.2 megapixels at this point. Like, and I'm just like on my floor looking at the camera, like doing push-ups. I'm like, this is creepy. Like, this is not like this. Like, this isn't going to get me into college football. And I, like, you know, you go back, look at it. And it's like, again, before, like the selfie era, and like, it was bad. It was really bad. And my friend was like, man, my best friend, he's like, my cousin just started a production company. He's super talented. I told him about you. He had seen my war footage. He's like, he thinks he can help you make this recruitment video. And he came to me, he's like, yeah, we'll make it. But if we make it, I want to tell a little bit about your background, what you've been doing, so these college coaches know you haven't just been, you know, doing nothing since you graduated high school. And so we did a day shoot. It was the day before Thanksgiving. I remember like starving myself, working out, and the next day I just pigged out. And like 3 days later, he comes with like the first round edit for this video that we shot. It was an all day shoot. I remember looking at it and be like, well, this is way better than my basement and a camera. Like, it was, you know, cinematic, had, like, you know, me running, all this stuff. I was like, dang, like, I don't even want to look away. Like, this is inspiring me. Like, this is inspiring me to go work out again. And so, you know, put that video up, and it was only meant for college coaches. And at this time, I didn't even know what the term viral even was. So I would go to sleep with my phone off, because if it chimed or whatever, it would kind of spook me. I remember waking up, you know, holding down power or whatever. And just like the text message thing, like text message voicemail thing, like just kept chiming. I was like, what in the heck? And yeah, I had hundreds of emails, voicemails, text messages, because at the end of my recruitment video, I put my personal home phone number, my personal cell phone, height, weight, date of birth, thinking that this was only relevant for college coaches. And a million views later in like the first week, I had to take it down, re-edit it, like take off all my stuff. But that really sparked the interest of who Daniel Rodriguez is post-military. And, you know, kind of on that realm or no, I think, it, you know, taking ownership is kind of putting yourself out there to some extent to give yourself something new to own. A lot of people talk about what they want to do or make promises and they never go accomplish it or put a foot forward to it. So sometimes exposing your desires and ambition is a form of owning it, or making it known to other people what you're trying to attain. And so that video did a lot of that in one kind of sweeping motion without me realizing what I was doing. Like I was really just trying to put it out there for college coaches. And I probably had about 150 more or less colleges reach out to me from D2 to D3 to D1 to JUCO. But I probably, and still to this day, have had well over 1,000 of people telling me their grief or their side of it or how my journey impacted them. So it was an extremely encouraging series of events, if you will, putting myself out there. Just all I kept telling myself was do this for Thompson, you know, live this out for your friends. And yeah, it was incredible, the journey and the feedback and recognition that the entire process received. So it was that's kind of my journey into college.
Your story is so powerful. And like I've said multiple times now, you absolutely have me on the edge of my seat here, and the passion and the inspiration in which you tell the story, and it is quite a story to be told, is amazing. I'm really curious, you know, I know you ended up playing 3 NFL games and then you got cut. How was that feeling after going through this massive transformation, not only a mindset transformation, but your life changed because of this promise that you made to Thompson? How was that feeling at the end of it all after you realized you were getting cut?
You know, I don't think the cut was the umbilical cord to the, right, or to the journey at that point. Because I got lost in the process of enjoyment and finding life for myself at the same time. Like, this was a lifelong dream. But also, that's why I kind of start off telling how I was raised, like what my love was, because this is ultimately, you know, father and teaching myself to what I had always been to do, and that was to play sports. So making it to the then being concussed thereafter, at that, I mean, I was concussed. I really don't remember it. Truthful, so I got cut in there. I got waved the next day, still concussed. Truthfully, so, but it was. I think once you hit levels of objectives or goals and you accomplish them or learn from their mistake or failures, whatever they might be, it kind of, it gives you a new, tool on your illness of what you're stimulating, even supposed to make it here to begin. That's everybody else, right? Everybody else is. I didn't even tell you stories of high school where basketball by a freshman, I went back after the Army was putting recruitment together. I was like, hey, I'd like to try to walk on tech. They laughed and said, hey, no, we can submit this to a smaller school, better chance. When I was in Clemson, my last pro game in Clemson, before I went to my pro day, I told my receivers coach, hey, I got invited to the Senior Bowl game tryout. He laughed. He's like, you're not going to that, right? I said, yeah, I am, right? So I had always been just on my own wave. And I think that was kind of an eye-opening experience of, like, you just proved everybody wrong. Like, even yourself, somebody's like, yeah, you're here, but nobody thought you were going to go too far anyway. So it was very – it hurt being concussed. Walking out the door, it also gave me a chip on my shoulder. Like, there's a million, I say this just guys, because there's a million guys that want to play in the, probably more. They will never, ever, like, I did. And they won't, because they won't have worked as hard as I have. And so it was a fulfillment at the same time walking out that I had gotten as much as I could out of the game of football before I felt the pendulum started swinging and it was getting more out of me. Like, what's the next injury? Like, yeah, it's a concussion now. But do I blow out my knee next game? Did I just save myself from potentially who knows what else? Right. So it sucked. Like, it was,
but
really
it was
the first
a
time I'd ever been cut in my life.
Like, yeah. Ever. But it sounds like to that. It sounds like it was also a blessing in disguise. Right. And I think that's a really powerful thing to say, you know what, the time has come, this is happening for a reason, and it's time to move on and it's time to find the next big thing.
I love also what you said, Daniel, before was that when you left there and you had this sense of peace about you, you had this sense of like, I've done it. I've done exactly what I was supposed to do. I set out to accomplish something. I've proved something to myself. And quite frankly, it's changed my mindset knowing that I can do whatever I want. There is nothing standing in my way. There is only me. And I think that's so powerful knowing that you can do whatever you want. And since then, you've now become an actor. You're a rapper. You're an artist. You're a musician. You travel to Medellin to learn Spanish. You do whatever you want because you are in control of certain portions of your life and driving this true level of ownership.
No, I think you're right. I think the and what you've said about me, like music and acting, that's also been lifelong dreams of mine. Like, I always wanted to act, like sports and movies. I was a Weird Al Yankovic, obsessed with Weird Al when I was a kid, like just the art of parody and writing. And I was a published poet at by 6 years old, I submitted my first poem to poetry. So I think what war also liberated me in the same sense is that I wasn't gonna waste my life for just whatever random BS, right? So when I came back, it was to start checking off objectives of where I left off at that 18-year-old adolescent kid. Like, this was a chance for me to prove to myself and also continue to keep my childlike mentality to accomplish what I wanted. So I'm, as much as war took a lot out of me, it also gave me a lot in perspective and drive and humility and also understanding and seeing death very early on. Your friends die. It's horrific at one end, but also like a reminder, like, you know, yes, hopefully I'm not gunned down in a war scenario, but life isn't forever. Like, from my father to my friends, like, you know, I have to live in this moment while I can. And I have reason to live for a greater moment because I've had friends who on the other end of the spectrum literally put their life on the line so I could get home. Whether they were fighting for my freedoms or not, I know those boys were putting their life on the line so we could get home, right? And so that's where I owe it to them. And that was such a defining, like, I'm not gonna waste this shit anymore. I'm not gonna waste these days or these ideas or these dreams or these passions because this is my life. And go ahead.
Those are true words. Those are really, really true words to live by, absolutely. I want to ask you a question that our listeners love to hear, and that is, and you kind of said it already, but what for you in a couple words or a quick phrase would you say is your definition of ownership? Somebody who is truly living in ownership every day and has had your fair share of struggles, what for you does it mean to live in ownership?
I think it's living in honesty for one, right? I love this quote. I can't remember where I heard it. It's simple. It's know thyself. Know thyself, your capabilities. What work have you put into it? Like, understanding where you are. And it's also, what are you looking to own? I think that's important, right? Like, some of us don't even take ownership for our own breath, what we say. That's something so simple, just to do what you say. I say that a lot when I speak. It's like, I just try to do what I say. Like, the effort that I put into it is so important to me, right? Because if I'm putting my effort into something, I want to take ownership for the actions. I like having that feeling of knowing I accomplished something. So for me, like, you know, spitballing here, like the whole, I mean, ownership is so, it's so important. I take such pride in whatever I write down or objectives of making sure that I put an effort towards it. And it doesn't always pan out the way that it's supposed to, or that I visualize it. But I think that having ownership in whatever it is, like whether it's a business, whether it's, you know, an idea, whatever it is, you just really have to show that that is you, because if you're putting an ownership towards it, then it also owns a part of you. And I feel that people, a lot of times, you know, they want to be a part of something and they want to start something, but they have no investment in it. And therefore it's not investing back in them. There's no ownership to that. And so if you really live by your words, if you're really passionate about what you want to accomplish, like you will find a way to really possess all of the actions and doing what you say, or being initiative, waking up and being consistent.
I love it. Daniel, where can, with everything that you've got going on, and being able to see you, be exposed to your content more, see you on the big screen, where can people find you, follow you, and engage with you?
Yeah, I'm on most social platforms, primarily Instagram and Twitter. I have my Twitter fan base is pretty big in college, so I put a lot of stuff there. My handle is DanielRod83. And on all other platforms, my YouTube page, Instagram page is Danny Del Rey. So my artist name is Danny Del Rey when I do music. And when I act, I do my full name is Daniel Ray Rodriguez.
I love it. I absolutely love it. So guys, as you go forward, as you really lean into yourself, there's so much here. There's so much to be blessed with. The fact that we are on our two feet, we have the ability to have freedoms. We don't have to get up and have to deal with somebody shooting at us, somebody trying to defend, but rather we can take ownership of our life today. It doesn't have to be tomorrow. It doesn't have to be next week, because those times may not come. And Daniel's story is the epitome of that. We can do whatever it is that we set our mind to. We alone can take ownership and lead with honesty with ourselves, honesty with our words, honesty with our actions, honesty with our follow through. And the more credibility we can build with ourselves, the greater it is that we're going to be able to accomplish anything. And taking everything that we have today, not for granted, but being aware of it, being actionable in it, and truly owning that process is a blessing. As we move forward, we know that success is not normal. Success is not something everybody seeks, but we don't want to be normal. We don't want to blend in. We want to be the exception. We want to lead from the front, just as Daniel did, just as Daniel experienced, and just as Daniel learned over the course of his time. So as you go forward, be different and own your different. We'll see you next week.